आवर 78th एपिसोड ऑफ फ्रीडम चौतारी पॉडकास्ट. इट्स मी आदित्य दहाल. टुडे दिस एपिसोड ऑफ फ्रीडम चौतारी पॉडकास्ट इज बेस्ड ऑन अ पॅनल डिस्कशन ऑन द ऑकेजन ऑफ ओल्ड प्रेस फ्रीडम डे बाय इंटरनॅशनल सेंटर फॉर जर्नालिस्ट. The discussion is focused on journalist safety and the role of free press in the context of COVID-19 pandemic globally. The episode provides information and experience from prominent and experienced journalists for the different corners of the globe on how journalism is affected by the current public health crisis and how media can play a vital role to curb this crisis. The panel includes Celia Benko, the director of Swedish Radio, Melinda Liu, the Beijing bureau chief of Newsweek magazine, Jason Regian, global opinion writer at the Washington Post. The session is moderated by ICFJ senior vice president Sharon Mosby.
Hi, everybody. I'm Sharon Moshavi. I am Senior Vice President at ICFJ, the International Center for Journalists. Thank you so much for coming to celebrate World Press Freedom with us today. We really appreciate it, recognizing, of course, that celebrating anything in the middle of a global pandemic, frankly, is kind of hard. And it feels like celebrating journalism right now is not the easiest thing in the world either. It is being attacked on so many fronts, from authoritarians and democracies using the pandemic as an opportunity to squash media freedoms. We're seeing crumbling business models, journalists being laid off, news organizations shutting down. We're seeing rising levels of mis and disinformation, declining levels of audience trust. You put all these things together and it really does make you wonder about the continued existence of journalism. It's something to worry about. But at the same time, we are seeing how incredibly vital and necessary journalism is right now. And so we need to not just defend it, but to celebrate it, and to celebrate the fact that journalists can do what governments can't, what special interests can't, and yes, even scientists can't do. And that is to hold the powerful to account, to deliver accurate news and information that is literally saving lives. As we like to say at ICFJ, it takes a journalist. We're trying to do our part to help. We've launched a COVID-19 initiative. We have leveraged our incredible, amazing network to create the Global Health Crisis Reporting Forum. We have more than 3,000 journalists from more than 1,000 countries. And that's because it's a global pandemic and it demands a global response. The forum is working across multiple languages. We're connecting journalists with experts, with each other, seeding collaborations and community, sharing information and resources. And we hope and we believe helping to improve coverage. And that coverage is absolutely crucial. We all know that the novel coronavirus appeared in late 2019 in Wuhan, China. The next big hotspot was Iran. Two countries without a free press. Neither one has that ability to really inform the public. And I think the entire world paid a price for that. It was only when the virus started to spread to countries with a free press that we really started to understand the magnitude of what we're seeing. Hundreds of thousands of people dead, dying, sick, public health systems brought to the brink, economies coming to a halt. Brave journalists and a free press have been incredibly important in covering the crisis, and they're going to be incredibly important in helping us to get through this. Journalism will quite literally save more lives. So I'm very honored today to have three incredible journalists joining us today who really understand the threats and challenges in the hot spots of the pandemic in Europe, in the US, Iran, and China. So let me introduce the three folks we have here today. Thank you so much again for joining us. We have Celia Benko. She is the Director General of Swedish Radio. She's also on the boards of the European Broadcasting Union and the International News Safety Institute. She's joining us today from Stockholm. We have Melinda Liu, who is the Beijing Bureau Chief for Newsweek magazine. She is an award-winning journalist who has been covering and living in Beijing on and off since 1998. She joins us, though, now from D.C., since she has not been able to get back to Beijing since February. And we have Jason Brazion, who is a writer for Global Opinions at the Washington Post. He was the Post's Tehran correspondent from 2012 to 2016, and he spent 544 days in an Iranian prison. Again, thank you all. Thanks, everybody, for joining this morning. Let me just start, and we'll be taking questions from everybody as well, but later as we go along. But let me start, Sila, by asking you a question. You write a lot and about media freedom. What from your vantage point right now? I listed a litany of things that are facing the press right now. From your perspective, what are the top one or two top threats we're seeing to journalism right now, as we attempt to navigate this crisis?
Well, thank you, and thanks for having me on the panel. I usually say that there are, numerous threats to freedom of the press and free speech around the world. And of course, all of them are a bit sort of exaggerated in times like these. But if you have to pick two, I would say political interference. Politicians trying to clamp down on media freedom, trying to use this as an opportunity to go ahead with things that they would have liked to do all the time. And also financial strain. I'm quite honestly very worried how many journalists will there be left after this pandemic is over, not because they are in any way in more harm than others. In a way they are, of course, because they're out there reporting, but also because of the whole financial model going down the drain, especially for commercial media, where you see all the advertising money just sort of not being there, which means layoffs and less people actually scrutinizing power after this is done.
Thanks for that. Not a good place to be right now. Belinda, let me ask you. This all started in Wuhan, China, with a whistleblower. Not a country with a reputation for a free media. We did see some relaxing. There's been some space for Chinese media to report. That space seems to open and close, obviously. Tensions are now rising globally around the world, with China being accused of withholding information. What has the Chinese media managed to do in this environment, and what have they not been able to do?
I think on a fundamental level, they still haven't changed the system of control, surveillance, increasing government resorting to high technology to exert a kind of a big brother environment on the media. That is still not only very much in place, but we see it actually increasing the pressure, just as Scylla said. What they have managed to do, however, is I think significant and worth keeping an eye on, which is, yes, this is a crisis. It's a global crisis. It began as a China crisis, but it wasn't seen as overtly. Let me put it this way. Public health emergencies can become very politicized, but because they because something like a virus or a tsunami or a fire or a train wreck, those things don't tend to choose their victims according to political requirements. Basically, everyone gets affected, and so it's harder. It was harder, I think, for the government to justify suppression, censorship, control, misinformation when it came to a pandemic that's killing people. Because even leaders would say, "Oh, am I going to be catching COVID?" Similarly, we saw pollution as an issue that a lot of people could see its impact on themselves. And so citizen journalists, doctors, specialists, I think they were encouraged for at least a little while out of the public interest to say things. And I'm not sure that can be completely put back into its box, even now.
There does seem to be efforts to put it back into the box. The disappearing, social media posts that are happening. Someone, I think a Wired story said covering China is like treat it like you're covering Snapchat. Take screenshots, it will disappear.
Absolutely.
How much are you seeing that starting to happen now, that people are using space that was briefly there and then finding that it's gone?
That actually, that sort of thing has been happening for a long time. So it's not new. I do think that people are becoming very creative technologically to stay one step ahead of the authorities. You might find, okay, I'm not going to name any for obvious reasons, but you know, you might find web-based methods of communicating that people are using. Often they get shut down, but you might find other ways. And there are also some pretty high-tech methods for, say, someone in the United States who's tech savvy to be monitoring social media mentions of such this topic or that topic, and like focusing on hotspots where, gosh, there's a lot of people there talking about a strange pneumonia kind of thing. So technology, much of this war, if you want to see it as a war between those who would censor and those who want to speak out, is being waged in the technological sphere. What's dangerous, I think, is that a lot of the surveillance hardware and software and motivation that one applies to countering a pandemic or any kind of public health emergency can also be easily adapted to checking up on people, where they are, what they're saying, who they're saying it to, looking at their social media. And so, you know, in our zeal to open up to surveillance technology, because everyone wants to know if they're close to a place where COVID-19 infected people are, but it also, that data also becomes available to people who can use it for other reasons as well.
Yeah, very, very good point. Jason, let's look at Iran for a bit here now, an even more restrictive media space. Also accusations that, you know, not being forthcoming about what's happening in the country. What are we seeing in terms of, are we able to get any accurate information about what's happening in Iran out? And how is the Iranian government treating the local media right now? Are they using this as an opportunity to put further pressure and to silence any kind of journalism?
Well, as you mentioned, and as I think is pretty well known, Iran is really one of the most repressive media landscapes in the whole world and has been for a very long time. It's been on a downward trend over the last couple of years. And you know, the notion of a free and independent press doesn't exist. A lot of good journalists who are actually trying very, very hard to inform the public have been silenced and fired from their news organizations because pressures from the government on management of newspapers and television stations. The number of foreign correspondents covering Iran has dwindled. You know, that began around the time of my wife and my arrest in 2014, and it's continued to decline ever since. But you know, I think when we talk about Iran in the coronavirus era, it's a really interesting case study because after Wuhan, China, Iran was really the first hotspot. There's a lot of commerce between that part of China and Iran and a lot of tourism back and forth between the two countries. So, you know, Iran was one of the first places where the virus really took off, and we were able to see a kind of a vision of how it was going to play out in other parts of the world. If you remember, in the first days and weeks of this, back in February, an Iranian health minister got on television, you know, batting his sweaty brow and coughing and saying that this is not an issue. Turns out he had coronavirus. Dozens of Iranian officials ended up with the virus. Several of them died. You know, the Iranian regime made decisions. We talk about the politicization of the virus. Iran had a decision to make in February. Would they go ahead with the parliamentary elections, knowing full well, the government knowing, that this virus had already landed on their soil and was spreading rapidly, or would they postpone it? Well, they went ahead with the election. And within a couple of weeks, the virus had spread far and wide. Some journalists have been arrested. Others have been harassed into silence. I don't think we have a good handle on what's going on in Iran around the coronavirus yet. It seems as though they might be facing a major second wave because they reopened their economy. The economy is on the verge of collapse because of sanctions placed on it by the U.S. and other countries. So, so many of these things that we in the free world looked at as sort of mind-boggling that leaders would put their society in such risk. And then to see those things repeated here in the U.S. and other democracies, I think has been really, should be an eye-opener for all of us living through this moment. But it's a warning shot to all of us and to all of our governments about how they will handle this. And, you know, my attitude is, as you said in your opening remarks, I mean, journalists have the opportunity to amplify public health information and save lives. I mean, we're not going to come up with a vaccine, but we are able to share this information far and wide. And I think we have to continue to do that in the face of all these challenges.
Thanks, Jason. So let's take a look right now at how it's being covered in democracies. And obviously the disease, then the next hotspot has been Europe, spread across Europe. And Sweden has been the outlier in how it has handled the pandemic. The country has not shut down the way many other democracies across Europe have shut down. The Swedish government made a decision to keep businesses open, schools open, et cetera, but while urging social distancing. Scilla, can you talk a bit about how the Swedish press has managed to cover this issue? Has it managed to cover it rigorously? Are there any red lines, any issues in the coverage?
Well, I think so far we have to also remember that Sweden has the oldest constitutional law in the world, dating back from 1766. Gives us free information and the free press. So and that has always been very much respected. Saying that, of course, also here we see signs and tendencies. And I think before talking too much about Sweden, I just also want to make a remark about Europe as a whole. And I think it's an interesting survey from IPI that came last week, where they had looked at incidents around the globe. And then what you can see is if you look at incidents towards journalists in these corona months of March and April, Europe is standing out, and that's quite interesting, I would say. Most of the incidents are coming from Europe, one third actually, if you look at the whole entire world. And out of this one third, 50% is actually from countries that are part of the European Union. So that also says something about how, I mean, society as a whole and how politicians as a whole are handling this corona crisis, also in countries that we know up till now have been, you know, fair and square democracies with respect of a free media environment. In Sweden, we had an incident just the other week where, I mean, we have a very, very strong law of access principle. I mean, basically it means that if you are employed by any organization or government or anything that are funded by public money, you're allowed to speak to journalists without revealing your name. I mean, you can be anonymous, and your employer are not allowed to trace you as a source. I mean, and this has been a really, really strict law and respected in Sweden. And then we saw just the other week how a municipality, as you say in English, a very hard word for Swede to pronounce, all of a sudden posted on their website internally saying to the staff that you're not allowed to speak to media if you have any information that has to do with COVID-19. I mean, of course, that's totally unrespectable in Sweden. And this goes on also in my home country. So I think we see in a lot of ways that, I mean, you can understand it in a way that politicians use this situation for emergency laws and things like that. They really want to grasp the virus. They need to do certain things. But what we have to keep in mind and be very, very cautious about is how much of this will stay when this is over. Hungary is a very good example. They also implemented a lot of new laws when they had a huge migration crisis in 2015. Almost all these laws are still in place. And in Hungary, as you know, I think you know at least, if you report on the COVID-19 in a wrong way, you may face 5 years in prison. And who decides what is a wrong way and what is fake news? I mean, so all this is going on around Europe in countries that used to at least once respect the freedom of the press and free speech. So I'm quite worried. I mean, that we see these tendencies in China and Iran, I mean, of course, that's horrid. But we are more used to that. But now we see it also coming up in countries like Italy, like Spain, like Greece, and that makes me worried.
That is concerning. Let's talk a little bit about the U.S. then in that context. Jason, there obviously have been tensions between the U.S. media and the administration here. You wrote in a column for Press Freedom, World Press Freedom Day just yesterday about the nature of personal attacks by the administration on journalists and how that differs from an attack on the media. How would you characterize the state of press freedom and media freedom and the ability of journalists to do their jobs in the current environment?
Well, look, I mean, I think that the point that Sheila was making about sort of emergency rules in democratic societies, I mean, you know, it's not only Europe, we see it also in India. Obviously, it's a big problem there. Brazil, Turkey, you know, has been on the decline for several years. But here in the U.S., I mean, I think it's an interesting situation because, you know, nobody is really saying that we can't report on things. But you have a commander-in-chief who takes a very antagonistic line towards individual journalists. And, you know, what I worry about is for the safety of those colleagues of mine when they leave those press briefings. Millions of people are watching those things. I mean, just as we heard that, you know, following President Trump's ridiculous remarks about, you know, light and disinfectants potentially helping, you know, combat the virus, and you hear about poisoning in the aftermath of that, when he gets up there and calls, you know, one of my Washington Post colleagues a faker and, you know, notorious for lying and spreading false information, how is that going to impact that person's life on the back end of that moment? You know, I think you made the point earlier about a lack of trust in what we do as journalists. The public's trust in us is waning. That's certainly true, but I think this personalization of attacks on journalists by the U.S. president is something that we have to pay very close attention to and figure out a way to better combat. Because I don't think the way to combat it is to amplify it by, you know, every cable news network coming out and saying, look what he said about this Washington Post or New York Times journalist. I think, you know, if anything, it creates more danger and even lack of more of a lack of respect and appreciation or trust for what it is that we do. So, you know, the short answer would be, I think that the First Amendment in the United States is secure for now, but we can't get complacent about this at all.
So speaking of trust, I think it's that's obviously it's a big issue as we've talked about. And Sheila, you've written a lot about hate speech and threats to media. What are you seeing in terms of, you've talked about how governments, even in Europe, are responding in not the best ways. What are you seeing in terms of how the public is viewing journalism and how what kind of trust we are having in our reporters?
Well, I have to say that in Sweden, we don't see a lack of trust. On the contrary, the trust figures are growing, especially for public service. And I think you have to remember also that we have a different kind of public service. And in the Nordic countries, we have very, very strict formats of public service where we are very independent from from government control, very independent from financial restraints and things like that. So we have great trust figures from the beginning. 72% of the public in Sweden have great trust in Swedish radio. And these figures have actually been growing during the pandemic and during this COVID-19. For instance, there was a survey last week that showed that we now have trust figures around 78%. So, I mean, and I think that has to do, of course, with the content. I mean, we are based in the entire country. We have 50 different locations and we do have an open society. We are allowed to scrutinize the power. We are allowed to ask the questions that are supposed to be asked. We are looking at research. We are looking at alternative research. And we give an open space. We are an open arena where thousands and thousands of voices can be heard and opinions can be shared. And that's, of course, something unique and very, very important in days like these. And I think people turn to us because they really, really see us as the trusted guide. And I'm very proud and happy about that. And what we can see is that there are, of course, movements in Europe where politicians want to have a less funding and a smaller and more limited remit for public service companies, but they are not in line with their voters. We had a big survey in Sweden just a couple of weeks ago, which shows that, I mean, basically people that are voting for any party have great trust in public service and in Swedish radio, except for the very far right. And I think this is something that we can also see during these days. I mean, our audience figures are booming. And that's not just in Sweden. I mean, the European Broadcasting Union have asked 27 of their members, and on an average, news consumption is up by 20%. And if you ask the young audiences, those who are sort of 16 to 24, it's up by 42%. And of course, this news consumption wouldn't be rising that much if they wouldn't trust us. So, I mean, I think we have, in that sense, different view on journalism and on public service and on trust in most European countries compared to, for instance, some of the countries in Asia, but also when it comes to the United States.
Melinda, can you talk a little bit about the levels of trust in any kind of media and social media? Where are Chinese citizens, where are they putting their trust in information right now? Are they trusting what they see in Chinese media outlets? Are they trusting what they see on social, on WeChat, when it's allowed to bubble up? Where does that stand, do you think?
Of course, China is a vast country with a huge population. I think the question of trust is a tricky one because something like a pandemic will rattle an individual citizen's relationships to people and institutions that are very far away, and it'll tend to strengthen those relationships with people who are close by. In China, often that means people in your village, people with the same surname, you know, a clan relationship, or people in a professional society. I think a lot of people now may feel it's more in their interest to listen to and trust the people around them that they can interact with all the time, who can help them, who can guide them, rather than, Beijing or the provincial capital especially, or the city government. Certainly in China, one phenomenon that's very prevalent is the level of trust in the local government is really in bad shape. And very often you see citizens trying to reach the central government in the belief, rightly or wrongly, that if only the center knew how corrupt and how wrong or how misguided or how incompetent the local authorities are, the center will come and put things right. And you see that narrative a little bit in terms of what happened in Wuhan. A lot of the blame for covering up and delaying and, let's hush up this strange illness because we're having a big party for 1,400 families in a hot pot festival. So we're going to see, I think, a lot of fragmentation. And I think a lot of people now simply believe what their friends and family and their village, you know, their small village. You know, my husband and I have a cottage in a very tiny village outside of Beijing. which is like, it's like medieval style lockdown. They are not letting foreigners, like, well, I can't, I'm even locked out of China, but if I had managed to be in Beijing, I wouldn't be allowed to get in there. They don't let anyone in. They have like a physical barrier across the road. And if you were to walk down the street and not belong in that village, likely you would be detained by someone and I don't know, police would be called and you would be removed. So we're getting into kind of a feudal mindset here. And I think it can be unpredictable because certainly some of these small circles, let's call them trust circles, will be highly critical of what the government has done. Others will not be. You know, the one thing that the pandemic has done is it's heightened the sense of nationalism, partly because the government has encouraged that. For them, that's their key to survival. No matter what happens in the world, what they, you know, if the Communist Party feels its hold on power threatened, it will go to the lowest common denominator, which is we Chinese are under threat. We need to unite together against this threat. And so we've seen an uptick in xenophobia and xenophobic speech and even xenophobic behavior, and also just heightened nationalistic rhetoric. So I think it's very clear the pandemic has changed a lot, and we won't know for a while how much of it is lasting damage and how much of it is temporary.
We're getting a lot of questions in through the Zoom chat. I'll try to, there's a bunch of them, but there are a number of questions about disinformation. Russia, China, Iran have been accused of disinformation campaigns around the coronavirus pandemic. Melinda, can you speak to the Chinese? What are you seeing from in terms of that? How much is that related to tensions with the U.S. and now the rest of the world about the investigation or lack thereof into the origins of the virus? So what does that disinformation look like, and how widespread is it?
Well, disinformation and propaganda have always been part of the government's toolkit for exerting control over society. What's really dangerous and relatively new, at least for, okay, my first experience living and working as a journalist in Beijing goes back to 1980. Okay, and what I see that's unprecedented now is basically Chinese diplomats who are usually well-educated and quite intelligent and usually quite good at serving their national interest. Basically, some of them have taken a page out of the Trump playbook with highly aggressive language, highly nationalistic language, politicized language, and blaming other countries to an intense degree. And it's not all diplomats. Normally, you know, say going back 10 years, Chinese diplomats were among the most careful and thoughtful Chinese officials you might encounter. There are other ministries which are much more powerful, where you get, you know, a little bit of aggression or aggressive language or, you know, testosterone contest. But anyway, this new breed of aggressive Chinese diplomat, it's called wolf warrior diplomacy. The wolf warriors refers to the title of a popular Chinese film, where basically, to summarize it, handsome rogue Chinese soldier overcomes huge odds to save the African continent, or in some cases, the entire world, which was a science fiction film. And they're seen as physically impressive, able to do martial arts. And very often there's a scene of, you know, this Chinese wolf warrior soldier doing battle with a much bigger and more muscular Caucasian soldier and beating the crap out of that guy. So this kind of wolf warrior diplomacy has crept into the foreign ministry in China, and there are a few of them tweeting just like Western politicians tweet, spreading unfounded theories just like we see in the West, and basically just muddling the waters. Interestingly, we see other more considerate, more thoughtful diplomats reacting against that. In some cases, it's a generational divide. The older, more mature ones are probably looking at these newcomers going, oh my God, you know, there goes several decades of the quiet diplomacy that we've been trying to do. But this is a brand new thing since the 80s, and it's hard to know whether that's going to become the norm in China or whether it's just seen as a survival tactic because so many Western countries are doing the same thing. Whatever the case is, the diversity of types of disinformation and types of characters who are spreading disinformation from the Chinese government side has blossomed during this pandemic. We're getting every kind, traditional Chinese kind, you know, cultural revolution type of very clumsy propaganda, as well as this aggressive populist Twitter tirade that they're getting pretty good at, some of them.
Not exactly the kind of blossoming we want to see this spring.
Not what we were hoping the West would be teaching to China, that's for sure.
Jason, let me ask you a little bit about Iran on that scale. They've also been accused of waging disinformation campaigns, but there also seems to be a fair amount of misinformation within the country. There was a report by the AP recently that said 700 people had died from taking toxic methanol to rid themselves of the coronavirus. Can you speak to that a little bit?
Sure. I think that the fact is in Iran, disinformation, as with China and other societies, goes alongside its propaganda campaigns and has, you know, since the beginning of the Islamic Republic 40 years ago. I would not put too much stock in Iran's international misinformation, disinformation campaigns. They are not on the same scale as Chinese or Russian ones. Every time we hear about Iranian campaigns on Twitter and Facebook and Instagram being shut down, when you see the number of followers that these accounts actually have, they're pretty minor. The bigger issue is how bad information is able to penetrate within Iranian society and flourish. You have this issue where there's a deficit of trust between the people and the state, and there has been for a very long time. Iran has a very strong domestic propaganda machine. The state television and radio are very much controlled and one-sided. But to counteract that, foreign-based exile or other forms of opposition have started television channels that beam into Iran via satellite. So, you know, everybody has a multitude of platforms that they're looking to for information. If you want to get the weather report in Iran, you turn on the state television. If you want to know what's going on in the recent protests or the price of bread, you turn on the BBC's Persian service. If you want to, you know, kind of vent your frustrations about how terrible Islamic rule is, you tune into one of these exile channels. So, you know, I think that's created a really tough situation around the pandemic, in that there's a lot of bad information about what could potentially help this virus. So in less informed, less educated parts of the country, a rumor was flourishing that if you drink alcohol, like industrial grade alcohol, it would act as kind of a prophylactic to getting the virus. So hundreds of people drank essentially rubbing alcohol and died. There are other non-scientific traditional methods that have flourished on the internet, and people have tried them and died. It's really similar to, you know, what I was speaking about earlier about President Trump's statements about, you know, things that might work to counter the virus. And unfortunately, there's really no liability on any of these hucksters who are spreading this sort of information within Iranian society. So, you know, I think transparency is the greatest antidote for this sort of poor information spreading. But I don't see that entering into Iranian society anytime soon.
Thanks, Jason. Scylla, we're getting, I'm looking through, scrolling through all the questions coming through, and I think the biggest theme I see in here is safety. How do I report on this safely? How do I, whether it's politicians, whether it's being attacked by a mob who doesn't like what you're doing, whether it's trying to get into a hospital, whether it's not having PPE, what advice could you give, and what are you seeing in terms of what journalists are managing to do or not managing to be able to do to report on this crisis safely?
Well, that's a tough one because, I mean, we are quite used to send people into high-risk areas, to be honest. And we have a lot of reporters out there on a daily basis working in very remote and very sort of difficult circumstances. But what we have to deal with now is that we have anxiety. We have anxiety among ordinary staff that are not used to and that don't have any special training. And as managers, we have had to work a lot with that, how to make sure that this anxiety is taken care of, because you have to respect that people are afraid of getting, you know, ill, or to spread the virus to people that they love, or to spread the virus to people that they interview or whatever, and cause more harm. Some people don't want to commute to work. Some people don't want to stay at home. I mean, there are all kinds of things that you have to deal with. We have tried to look through every safety measure that is possible, make it as, you know, as good an environment as possible for our staff to work in. We have used the knowledge that we have from how you work in difficult and remote areas and implemented what is possible to implement also here in Sweden. We have came out with new, you know, guidelines, tricks, tips, whatever, in some ways also new equipment to make it easier to make a radio interview for people. For instance, we, you know, to keep 2 meters distance and still be able to do the interview. But we also actually have developed our own technology so that we have an app in that you can send through an SMS to those you want to interview, and they download it temporarily, and then you get a good audio feed where you can do high quality audio interviews without even having to sort of get very close to each other, and it sounds like you're in the same studio. So there are certain things that you could do with the help of technology. And we have also worked on the on you know, the anxiety part, sitting down, talking to people, make people feel that we as their employer are doing all we can to keep them as protected as possible.
That makes a lot of sense. Milind, I want to ask you a little bit about Hong Kong. No, jumping topics here, but I think it's really interesting. And as again, I'm looking through a lot of the questions, and people are sort of asking, you know, how do you cover that space where you kind of have some freedom, but you don't have a lot? And Hong Kong obviously is an interesting animal. It's coming out of the democracy protests last year or over the past year. And there has been a lot of great coverage of the coronavirus pandemic now. What's going on? If you can talk a little bit about what's happening in Hong Kong and what kind of media space freedom journalists have had and currently have now, because it's a fluid situation.
Right. I think that's a great question. And there's no doubt about it. That space is shrinking, and it's shrinking fast. One reason for that is, as Scylla mentioned in the very beginning of this segment, you know, Hong Kong's reason for being is commerce. It's a money place. It's a place of business. It's a place of finance. And even if you weren't dealing with politics at all, the business model for decent journalism is changing dramatically. Probably the highest profile outspoken journalistic leadership figure there is Apple Daily has traditionally been one of the most independent voices in Hong Kong. And he makes it very clear that, you know, the pressures that had been exerted on him going back for years, which is mainly pro-Beijing elements and Chinese authorities pressuring advertisers not to advertise, well, it's all coming to a head. He's not sure how sustainable Apple Daily will be. And that is magnified across the field. You know, it is so easy for the financial and business side pressures of this COVID period to be the straw that breaks a camel's back for a lot of independent media. Okay, and then if that weren't enough to worry about, Beijing is also hoping to use this whole pandemic response period as a reset for Hong Kong and for dealing with especially foreign media, because Hong Kong has traditionally been a great place to be able to keep an eye on China without being in China and subject to all the pressures that you are as a foreign correspondent in China. So one thing that's happened that everyone I think should be concerned about is number one, Beijing has cracked down tremendously on the number of foreign correspondents able to live and work in Beijing. Recently, more than 13 have been affected. These are non-Chinese foreign nationals reporting on international reporting for international media. More than 13 of them have been affected by China's withdrawal of press reporting credentials for them, which would basically require them to immediately stop doing journalism, and then because they don't have any chance of renewing those press credentials, their visas will expire this year and they will have to leave. So many of my friends who I've known for many years, many of them worked for me, are now in the process of leaving. So it's not bad enough that they're all totally disrupted. You know, pandemic reporting has been hugely challenging. Two of them are having babies right about now, and they all have to leave China with their families. Okay, the Hong Kong angle for this is that some of them in the past might have said, okay, but I can still use my China reporting expertise and experience and credentials to report from Hong Kong and still keep an eye on China, you know, greater China. That now is also no longer open to them. Part of the deal for this quasi-expulsion or crypto-expulsion is that they can't relocate in Hong Kong and continue to work as foreign correspondents. And even though Hong Kong was supposed to have its own system to be independent under something called the One Country, Two Systems formula, and you know, even though it has had a tradition of outspoken media, it now appears that the days that where foreign correspondents could be based in Hong Kong and tell it like it is in Hong Kong, just as you did in the West, those days are numbered, I fear. Already we've also seen the denial of visas to visiting foreign correspondents as well. That's a big change. And of course it changes our whole ability to understand not only what's going on in Hong Kong, but also what's going on in China.
You know, you use the phrase just now, telling it like it is. And I just, again, I'm trying to get in as many questions from folks as we can. I'm sort of synthesizing things. But one of the big questions I'm seeing kind of repeated in various forms here is about that ability to tell it like it is, whether you're in a more repressive country or not. How do you, a journalist from India actually kind of sums up the question well. It says, she says, in terms of accessing data or working with numbers, reporting on health issues is always fraught with balancing between exaggeration and underreporting. How do we deal with that now? There's this, you know, the rush, the reporting on vaccines, not vaccines. If journalism is in a media space, there is the difficulty of now trying to report on something that is almost unknowable. There's so much we don't know. And so I'm wondering where the responsibility and where the technique of journalism lies right now in trying to find that balance, if you will, and report numbers that are reliable and accurate, but do we know that? So Jason, any thoughts on that?
Well, I mean, I think this is one more point on why the importance of local journalism is so relevant right now, and its demise is so destructive and heartbreaking. If we're not able to, in the United States, where we're able to report relatively freely, if we don't have a presence in large swaths of the country, if there's not a correspondent that covers every state or every municipality or county, How are we going to get those accurate numbers? I don't have a good answer for that. But what I can say is the antidote or the response can't be to make wild projections about what may or may not happen. And, you know, I think one thing that I've been noticing and just kind of thinking about over the last few days as I read the coverage of the pandemic, but also watch coverage on the news, you know, all these channels, you have a mounting death toll and the number of cases really depersonalizes the situation. What I'm not seeing very much of is, you know, what it's actually like inside a hospital, right? I mean, there's been very few reports like that. And, you know, I think the broader questions about how do we get people to care about this issue and to take it seriously, because so many people are acting as though the COVID-19 is a hoax, it doesn't exist. You know, I'm just listing off issues at this point. There aren't a lot of answers. And I think we have to take a good long look at how we handle this pandemic so that we don't bungle it the next time around.
This is true. So I just want to mention here that, so ICFJ and the Tau Center at Columbia University, we are embarking on a study trying to understand what the short and long-term implications of the pandemic is going to be on journalism. And obviously, there are many. We've all listed so many issues, financial, press freedom. There are a multitude of issues here. Scylla, you wrote an article for World Press Freedom Day Now calling for a UN special representative to safeguard journalists. What going forward, what is that going to help with at this point, do you think?
Well, it will put another dimension maybe to all these discussions that we are having now, some more power behind it. It's not my idea. It's an idea that's been around for a long time. It was, I think, originally created by Reporters Without Borders. It got some political support from Macron and others. I know Juncker and so forth. I know that the Secretary General of the UN is not too happy about the whole idea. Or, I mean, he might like it, but he doesn't really want to have it, I think. I think he thinks that what UN has in place right now is sufficient, and it might be. I just see that, I mean, talk is not enough. There also has to be action. And at least in Sweden, we talk a lot about now to keep track of what's going on in the European Union. I mean, how can you have member countries that have actually implementing laws now that are really against freedom of expression and free press? How long are they supposed to be members of the club? Is there anything you can do about it? And I think if you have a UN representative, that person would be 100% dedicated to the issue and would have more power behind the actions. And I always say to the Swedish politicians that if you go to a country for any reason, doesn't matter what kind of minister you are, you should always ask, does this country have freedom of the press? And if it doesn't, do they have the laws in place? If they don't, why don't they? Do they have journalists in jail? If they do, you should demand them to be released. I mean, there are certain things you can do, but then you need sort of power behind it. And I mean, at least UN is supposed to be a very powerful organization. So, of course, if you would have a special representative or a special, I mean, representative directly reporting to the Director General of the United Nations, of course, that would mean more power to the discussions.
Great. Well, I know we have to go soon, but I just want to flag one more question to leave us on a somewhat, I don't know, feeling the power of journalism, I would say. Can any of you point to stories or to particular things that we wouldn't know if it were not for journalists? What are journalists and journalism? What are they doing right now that is getting it right, that really is making a difference? I'll open that up to any of you.
Well, I think we're making a huge difference. I mean, the reporting on this, if you look at my paper as an example, goes back to early January. I mean, you know, We were doing our job, and not just us, hundreds and thousands of news organizations around the world were sounding the alarm about this. If our governments tried to deny that this was a looming reality for us, That's not something that we have to take responsibility for. I mean, I think we haven't been deficient in doing our jobs. And I think that, you know, as I said earlier, I mean, we're not going to find the cure for this, but we will help save lives by sharing what's happening and the new information that comes forward every day. Without us, I don't know how that gets out.
Stiller, Melinda, any other final words? Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah. Well, we do journalistic reviews. We ask the controversial questions. We claim the facts. We make sure that there are many perspectives out there. Many voices are being heard. We choose freely. We are not in the hands of government control when it comes to what kind of stories we should report. We scrutinize those in power, but we also scrutinize the research. And we also let the audience in, actually. We ask the audience for their opinion. We let them make their voices heard. We try to explain. We try to put news into context to make people, help them to understand. And we can see that we have the audience with us. I mean, our audience figures are booming. And if we look, for instance, just on our science news, I mean, the audience figures for those have tripled. So, of course, we have a huge role to play here. And also what we can do is that we can actually make facts and personal views, which is not always the case if you, for instance, only follow this story on social media, where there are a lot of experts out there that claim that personal views are the same as facts. And hopefully, if you go to a traditional media outlet, we will help you in actually claiming what is a fact and what is a personal view.
Yes, and if I might add just very briefly, I think that's a really great question. And I think the most important piece of media coverage to come out of this pandemic era is probably the one that hasn't yet come out, but is clearly being worked on. People are gathering information, and one day it will be there, which is, I think media is going to be the primary mover in publicizing where the origins of this virus were or whether it is undeterminable. It is very, very, very difficult, and the the biased or politicized perspectives on this pandemic, but there is a great world, a universe of epidemiologists and virologists and medical researchers and of epidemic surveillance network specialists out there who are not into politics. They do their job extremely well, and journalists will find the ones who are at the cutting edge. Maybe they'll have a report that will be a cutting edge, and it'll be the media that helps bring it to the eyes of the public. I know these people are there. In 2017, I wrote an article for Smithsonian titled, it was pegged to the 100th year of the 1918 flu pandemic, and it was titled, Will China Be Ground Zero for the World's Next Pandemic? And I talked to more than a dozen experts. Some of those people will be the ones who help talk to media and get that piece out there. And I think that will be extremely useful.
Great. Thanks, Melinda. Thank you, everyone. I think Zoom is telling us it's time to go. It's giving out now. Again, thanks, everyone, for joining. Really appreciate both the panelists and everybody who came in. Journalists, if you haven't already, please join our Global Health Crisis Reporting Forum. You can find the link on our website. It's really, really an amazing community. And keep a lookout for our survey on how the pandemic is going to be affecting journalism going forward that we're doing in collaboration with the Tau Center at Columbia University. That will be landing in your inbox shortly. And lastly, just want to give a shout out. We'll be having a webinar on Friday with Sweden's public health, number one public health expert, Anders Tegnell, about the Swedish approach, which is, as I said, has been getting a lot of attention. Again, thank you, Scylla, Jason, and Melinda, all of you for joining. And it takes a journalist, everybody. Thanks very much, and happy World Press Freedom Day. Bye-bye.
Dear listeners, how do you find today's episode? If you have any suggestions and feedbacks regarding our podcast, do write to us at freedomforum2005@gmail.com. Or you can call us at our toll-free number 1-66-00-10-2022. That is 1-66-00-10-2022. With this, I, Aditya Dahal, would like to end today's episode. Till then, keep listening Freedom Chowdhury podcast. Thank you.